Penguin Random House Audio proudly presents Lincoln in the Bardo by George Saunders. Read by Nick Offerman, David Sedaris, George Saunders, and a full cast. Book 1. 1.
On our wedding day, I was 46, she was 18. Now I know what you are thinking. Older man, not thin, somewhat bald, lame in one leg, teeth of wood, exercises the marital prerogative, thereby mortifying the poor young. But that is false. That is exactly what I refused to do, you see. On our wedding night, I clumped up the stairs, face red with drink and dance, found her arrayed in some thinnish thing an aunt had forced her into, silk collar fluttering slightly with her quaking, and could not do it. Speaking to her softly, I told her my heart. She was beautiful. I was old. Ugly, used up. This match was strange, had its roots not in love, but expedience. Her father was poor, her mother ill. That was why she was here. I knew all of this very well, and would not dream of touching her, I said, when I could see her fear, and, the word I used, was distaste. She assured me she did not feel distaste, even as I saw her, fair, flushed face distort with the lie. I proposed that we should be friends, should behave outwardly in all things as if we had consummated our arrangement. She should feel relaxed and happy in my home and endeavor to make it her own. I would expect nothing more of her. And that is how we lived. We became friends, dear friends. That was all. And yet that was so much. We laughed together, made decisions about the household. She helped me bear the servants more in mind, speak to them less perfunctorily. She had a fine eye and accomplished a successful renovation of the rooms at a fraction of the expected cost. To see her brighten when I came in, find her leaning into me as we discussed some household matter, improved my lot in ways I cannot adequately explain. I had been happy, happy enough, but now I often found myself uttering a spontaneous prayer that went simply, "She is here, still here." It was as if a rushing river had routed itself through my house, which was pervaded now by a freshwater scent and the awareness of something lavish, natural, and breathtaking, always moving nearby. At dinner one evening, unprompted, before a group of my friends, she sang my praises, said I was a good man, thoughtful, intelligent, kind. As our eyes met, I saw that she had spoken in earnest. Next day, she left a note on my desk. Although shyness prevented her from expressing this sentiment in speech or action, the note said, my kindness to her had resulted in an effect much to be desired. She was happy, was indeed comfortable in our home, and desired, as she put it, to expand the frontiers of our happiness together in that intimate way to which I am as yet a stranger. She requested that I guide her in this, as I had guided her in so many other aspects of adulthood. I read the note, went in to supper, found her positively aglow. We exchanged frank looks there in front of the servants, delighted by this thing we had somehow managed to make for ourselves from such unpromising materials. That night, in her bed, I was careful not to be other than I had been. Gentle, respectful, deferential. We did little. Kissed, held one another. But imagine, if you will, the richness of this sudden indulgence. We both felt the rising tide of lust, yes, of course, but undergirded by the slow, solid affection we had built. A trustworthy bond, durable and genuine. I was not an inexperienced man. Had been wild when young, had spent sufficient time, I am ashamed to say, in Marble Alley, at the Bandbox, at the dreadful Wolf's Den. Had been married once before, and healthily so. But the intensity of this feeling was altogether new to me. It was tacitly understood that next night we would further explore this new continent, and I went to my printing offices in the morning, fighting the gravitational pull that bid me stay home. And that day, alas, was the day of the beam. Yes, yes, what luck. A beam from the ceiling came down, hitting me just here, as I sat at my desk. And so our plan must be deferred while I recovered. Per the advice of my physician, I took to my... a sort of sick box, was judged to be...
Hans Vollmann.
Efficacious.
Roger Bevins III.
Efficacious, yes. Thank you, friend.
Always a pleasure.
There I lay, in my sick box, feeling foolish in the parlor, the very parlor through which we had recently... gleefully, guiltily, her hand in mine, passed en route to her bedroom. Then the physician returned, and his assistants carried my sick box to his sick cart, and I saw that our plan must be indefinitely delayed. What a frustration! When, now, would I know the full pleasures of the marriage bed? When behold her naked form? When would she turn to me in that certain state, mouth hungry, cheeks flushed? When would her hair, loosened in a wanton gesture, fall at last around us? Well, it seemed we must wait until my recovery was complete. A vexing development indeed.
And yet all things may be borne.
Quite so. Although I confess I was not of that mind at the time. At that time, there on the sick cart, as yet unbound, I found I could briefly leave my sick box, darting out and causing little dust storms, and even cracked a vase on the porch. But my wife and that physician, earnestly discussing my injury, did not notice. I could not abide it. And threw a bit of a tantrum, I admit, and sent the dogs yipping away by passing through them and inducing in each a dream of a bear. I could do that then. Those were the days. Now I could no more induce a dream of a bear in a dog than I could take our silent young friend here out to dinner. He does appear young, doesn't he, Mr. Bevins? In his contours, his posture. In any event, I returned to my sick box, weeping in that way that we have. Have you come to know this yet, young fellow? When we are newly arrived in this hospital yard, young sir, and feel like weeping, what happens is we tense up ever so slightly, and there is a mildly toxic feeling in the joints, and little things inside us burst. Sometimes we might poop a bit if we are fresh. Which is just what I did, out on the cart that day. I pooped a bit while fresh, in my sick box, out of rage. And what was the result? I have kept that poop with me all this time. And, as a matter of fact, I hope you do not find this rude, young sir, or off-putting. I hope it does not impair our nascent friendship. That poop is still down there at this moment, in my sick box, albeit much drier. Goodness, are you a child? He is, isn't he?
I believe so, now that you mention it. Here he comes, nearly fully formed now.
My apologies. Good God! To be confined to a sick box while still a child, and have to listen to an adult detailing the presence of a dried poop in his sick box is not exactly the ideal way to make one's entree into a new, a boy. A mere lad, oh dear. Many apologies.
Two.
You know, Mrs. Lincoln said to me, the president is expected to give a series of state dinners every winter, and these dinners are very costly. If I give 3 large receptions, the state dinners can be scratched from the program. If I can make Mr. Lincoln take the same view of the case, I shall not fail to put the idea into practice.
I believe you are right, said the president. You argue your point well. I think that we shall have to decide upon the receptions.
The question was decided, and arrangements were made for the first reception.
In Behind the Scenes or 30 Years a Slave and 4 Years in the White House by Elizabeth Keckley.
Abolitionists criticized the merrymaking at the White House, and many declined to attend. Ben Wade's regrets were said to have been harshly worded. Are the President and Mrs. Lincoln aware that there is a civil war? If they are not, Mr. and Mrs. Wade are, and for that reason decline to participate in feasting and dancing.
In Reveille in Washington, 1860 to 1865, by Margaret Leach.
The children, Tad and Willie, were constantly receiving presents. Willie was so delighted with the little pony that he insisted on riding it every day. The weather was changeable, and exposure resulted in a severe cold which deepened into fever.
Keckley, op sit.
Willie was burning with fever on the night of the 5th as his mother dressed for the party. He drew every breath with difficulty. She could see that his lungs were congested, and she was frightened.
In 20 Days by Dorothy Meserve Kuhnhart and Philip B. Kuhnhart, Jr.
3.
The Lincoln's party had been savagely attacked, but all the important people had come to it.
Leach, opposite.
A clear sight line could not be obtained for the crush. One moved, dazed, through a veritable bazaar of scents, colognes, perfumes, fans, hair pieces, hats, grimacing faces, mouths held open in sudden shrieks. Whether joyful or terrified, it was difficult to say.
In all this did I see memories of a terrible time. By Mrs. Margaret Garrett.
Exotic flowers from the presidential greenhouse were in vases every few yards.
Kuhnhart and Kuhnhart upset.
The diplomatic corps made a brilliant group. Lord Lyons, Monsieur Mercier, Monsieur Steckel, Monsieur von Limburg, Senor Tassara, Count Piper, Chevalier Bertinotti, and the rest.
Leach, opposite.
Multi-tiered chandeliers illuminated the East Room, above carpets of seafoam green.
In Rise to Greatness by David Vondrely.
A patter of languages sounded in the Blue Room, where General McDowell, conversing in perfect French, was made much of by the Europeans.
Leach, opposite.
Every nation? Race, rank, age, height,
Breadth, voice, pitch, hairstyle, posture, and fragrance seemed represented. A rainbow come to life, calling out in manifold accents.
Garrett, opposite.
There were cabinet members, senators, representatives, distinguished citizens, and beautiful women from nearly every state. Few army officers were present below the rank of division commander. The French princes had come, and Prince Felix Salm-Salm, a Prussian nobleman and cavalry officer who was serving on General Blenker's staff.
Leech, opposite.
The dashing German, Salm-Salm. The Whitney brothers, twins, and indistinguishable, except that one wore a captain's ribbons and the other those of a lieutenant. Ambassador Thorne Tooley, Mr. and Mrs. Fessenden, the novelist E.D.E.N. Southworth, George Francis Train, and his beautiful wife, half his age, twice his height, ran a witticism popular at the time.
Garrett, opposite.
Nearly lost among a huge flower arrangement stood a clutch of bent old men in urgent discussion. Heads centrally inclined. These were Abernethy, Seville, and Cord, all of whom would be dead within the year. The Caston sisters, terrifically tall and pale, stood at a slant nearby, like alabaster anthers seeking light, attempting to overhear the conversation.
In The Union Citadel, Memories and Impressions by Joe Brunt.
Before them all, at 11 o'clock, Mrs. Lincoln led the promenade around the East Room on the President's arm.
Leech, opposite.
As we surged forward, a man unknown to me demonstrated a new dance, the Merry Jim. At the urging of those gathered around, he demonstrated it again, to applause.
Garrett, opposite.
There was great hilarity when it was discovered that a servant had locked the door of the state dining room and misplaced the key. "I am in favor of a forward movement," cried one. "An advance to the front is only retarded by the imbecility of commanders," said another, parroting a recent speech in Congress.
Leech, opposite.
This, it occurred to me, this was the undisciplined human community that, fired by its dull collective wit, now drove the armed nation towards it knew not what sort of epic martial cataclysm. A massive flailing organism with all the rectitude and foresight of an untrained puppy.
In the Private Letters of Albert Sloan, by permission of the Sloan family.
The war was less than a year old. We did not yet know what it was.
In A Thrilling Youth, A Civil War Adolescence, by E.G. Frame.
When at last the key was found, and the merry guests poured in, Mrs. Lincoln had reason for pride in the magnificence of the repast.
Leech, opposite.
The room was 40 feet long by 30 feet wide, and so bright with color it seemed to be full before anyone entered.
In The Lincolns, Portrait of a Marriage, by Daniel Mark Epstein.
Costly wines and liquors flowed freely, and the immense Japanese punch bowl was filled with 10 gallons of champagne punch.
Leech, opposite.
Mrs. Lincoln had engaged the esteemed caterer C. Hurt of New York. The cost was rumored to be over $10,000. Nor had any detail been overlooked. The chandeliers were garlanded with flowers, the serving tables decorated with rose petals scattered over cut rectangles of mirror.
Brunt, opposite.
A piggish and excessive display in a time of war.
Sloan, opposite.
Elsa was speechless and only kept squeezing my hand. In such a way, one felt, the ancients must have entertained. What generosity! How kind our dear hosts.
In Our Capital in Time of War by Peterson Wickett.
In the dining room was a long table with a gigantic looking glass upon it, bearing massive confections of sugar. Most recognizable were Fort Sumter, a warship, a Temple of Liberty, a Chinese pagoda, a Swiss cottage.
Kunhardt and Kunhardt opposite.
Sweetened replicas of a temple surrounded by the Goddess of Liberty, Chinese pagodas, cornucopias, fountains with sprays of sponge sugar, and encircled by stars.
In Mr. Lincoln's Washington by Stanley Kimmel.
Hives, swarming with lifelike bees, were filled with Charlotte Russe. War was gently hinted at by a helmet with waving plumes of sponge sugar. The good American frigate Union, with 40 guns and all sails set, was supported by cherubs draped in the stars and stripes.
Leach, opposite.
Fort Pickens also loomed up in sugar on a side table, surrounded by something more edible than barbette guns, in the shape of a deliciously prepared chicken fixins.
Kimmel, opposite.
The flowing sugar gown of Lady Liberty descended like drapery upon a Chinese pagoda, inside of which, in a pond of candy floss, swam miniature fish of chocolate. Nearby, lusty angels of cake waved away bees hung aloft on the thinnest strings of glaze.
Wicket, opposite.
At first, delicate and perfect, over the course of the night, this candy metropolis suffered various ravages, members of the party taking away entire quarters of the city in fists, into pockets, to share with loved ones at home. Later in the evening, the glass table being jostled by the crush, certain of the candied edifices were seen to give way.
Garrett, opposite.
They dined on tender pheasant, fat partridge, venison steaks, and Virginia hams. They battened upon canvasback ducks and fresh turkeys, and thousands of tidewater oysters, shucked an hour since and iced, slurped raw, scalloped in butter and cracker meal, or stewed in milk.
Epstein, opposite.
These and other tasty morsels were spread about in such profusion that the joint attack of the thousand or more guests failed to deplete the array.
Kimmel, opposite.
Yet there was no joy in the evening for the mechanically smiling hostess and her husband. They kept climbing the stairs to see how Willie was, and he was not doing well at all.
Kunhardt and Kunhardt, opposite. 4.
The rich notes of the marine band in the apartments below came to the sick room in soft, subdued murmurs, like the wild, faint sobbing of far-off spirits.
Keckley, opposite.
Willie lay in the Prince of Wales bedroom with its dark purple wall hangings and golden tassels.
Epstein, opposite.
The cheeks of his handsome round face were inflamed with fever. His feet moved restlessly beneath the maroon coverlet.
In History Close at Hand, edited by Renard Kent, account of Mrs. Kate O'Brien.
The terror and consternation of the presidential couple may be imagined by anyone who has ever loved a child and suffered that dread intimation common to all parents, that fate may not hold that life in his higher regard and may dispose of it at will.
In Selected Civil War Letters of Edwin Willow, edited by Constance Mays.
With fear clutching at their hearts, they went downstairs once more to hear the singers of the evening, the Hutchison family, give a frighteningly real rendition of the song Ship on Fire, which required simulation of a violent thunderstorm at sea, the frightened screams of the trapped passengers, a mother pressing her babe to her bosom of snow, a tramp, a rout, an uproar of voices, fire, fire. The cheeks of the sailors grew pale at the sight, and their eyes glistened with the gleam of the light, and the smoke in thick wreaths mounted higher and higher. Oh God, it is fearful to perish by fire.
Kunhart and Kunhart upset.
The noise and clatter were such that to be understood it was necessary to shout. Carriages continued to arrive, windows were thrown open, and groups formed around them, hoping for a gust of chill night air. An air of happy panic pervaded the room. I began to feel faint, and believe I was not alone in this. Matrons were collapsed here and there in armchairs. Drunken men examined paintings rather too intensely.
Garrett, upset.
Wild shrieks rang out.
Sloane, upset.
One fellow stood in perfect happiness, orange trousered, blue coat flung open, feasting in place, as he stood at the serving table like some magnificent Ambrosi, finally found the home of his dreams.
Wicket, upset.
The flower arrangements of history, those towering bursts of colors so lavish, soon tossed away, to dry and go drab in the dim February sun. The animal carcasses, the meat, warm and sprig-covered, on expensive platters steaming and succulent, trucked away to who knows where, clearly awful now, honest partial corpses once again, after brief elevation to the status of delight-giving food. The thousand dresses, laid out so reverently that afternoon, flecks of dust brushed off carefully in doorways, hems gathered up for the carriage trip, where are they now? Is a single one museum displayed? Are some few yet saved in attics? Most are dust, as are the women who wore them so proudly in that transient moment of radiance.
In The Social Life of the Civil War, Frolic, Carnage, Extirpation, unpublished manuscript by Melvin Carter.
5.
Many guests especially recalled the beautiful moon that shone that evening.
In A Season of War and Loss by Anne Briney.
In several accounts of the evening, the brilliance of the moon is remarked upon.
In Long Road to Glory by Edward Holt.
A common feature of these narratives is the golden moon, hanging quaintly above the scene.
In White House Soirees, an anthology by Bernadette Yvonne.
There was no moon that night, and the sky was heavy with clouds.
Wicket, upset.
A fat green crescent hung above the mad scene like a stolid judge, inured to all human folly.
In My Life by Dolores P. Leventrop.
The full moon that night was yellow-red, as if reflecting the light of some earthly fire.
Sloane, upset.
As I moved about the room, I would encounter that silver wedge of a moon at this window or that, like some old beggar who wished to be invited in.
Carter, upset.
By the time dinner was served, the moon shone high and small and blue above, still bright, albeit somewhat diminished.
In A Time Departed, unpublished memoir by I.B. Brigg III.
The night continued dark and moonless. A storm was moving in.
In Those Most Joyful Years by Albert Trundle.
The guests began to depart as the full yellow moon hung among morning stars.
In The Washington Powers by D.V. Featherly.
The clouds were heavy, leaden, and low, of a dull roseate color. There was no moon. My husband and I paused to look up at the room in which young Lincoln suffered. I said a silent prayer for the health of the lad. We found the carriage and made for home, where our own children, thanks be to a merciful God, were resting peacefully.
In One Mother Remembers by Abigail Service. 6.
The last guests lingered almost until dawn. In the basement, servants worked all night to clean up, drinking leftover wine as they toiled. Hot, tired, and drunk, several of them began arguing, which led to a fist fight in the kitchen.
Vondreli, upset.
I heard it said several times in hushed whispers. It was wrong to engage in such merrymaking when death itself had made itself known at the door, and perhaps the more modest the public life at such a time, the more apposite.
In collected wartime letters of Barbara Smith Hill, edited by Thomas Schofield and Edward Moran.
The night passed slowly. Morning came, and Willie was worse.
Keckley, opposite. Seven.
Yesterday around 3, there came a considerable procession. Perhaps 20 carriages and nowhere to put them. They stopped on the lawns of the houses and sat aslant on the cemetery land by the fence. And who should alight from the hearse but Mr. L. himself, whom I could recognize from his likeness, but sore, bent down, and sad in countenance, almost needing to be urged along, as if reluctant to enter that drear place. I had not yet heard the sad news, and was momentarily puzzled, but soon enough, the situation being made clear, I prayed for the boy and family. It has been much in the papers regarding his illness, and it has had the unhappy outcome now. The carriages continued to arrive over the next hour until the street was impassable. The large crowd disappeared inside the chapel, and from my open window I could hear the proceedings within, music, a sermon, weeping. Then the gathering dispersed and the carriages moved off, several becoming stuck and requiring unsticking, the street and lawns being left a considerable mess. Then today, again wet and cold, and around 2, a single small carriage arrived and stopped at the cemetery gate, and again the president got out, this time accompanied by 3 gentlemen, 1 young and 2 old. They were met at the gate by Mr. Weston and his young assistant, and all went off to the chapel. Before long, the assistant being joined by a helper, they were seen to be managing a small coffin onto a handcart, and off the sad party went, cart in the lead, the president and his companions plodding along behind. Their destination appeared to be to the northwest corner of the cemetery. The hill there being steep and the rain continuing, it made a strange joining of somber melancholy and riotous awkwardness, the assistant struggling to keep the tiny coffin upon the cart, and at the same time all parties, even Mr. L., diligently mincing to maintain their footing on the rain-slick grass. Anyway, it appears the poor Lincoln child is to be left there across the road, contrary to reports in the newspapers, which ventured that he would be returning to Illinois forthwith. They have been loaned a place in the crypt belonging to Judge Carroll. And only imagine the pain of that, Andrew, to drop one's precious son into that cold stone like some broken bird and be on your way. Quiet tonight, and even the creek seems to murmur along more quietly than usual, dear brother. The moon came out just now and lit the stones in the cemetery. For an instant, it appeared the grounds had been overrun with angels of various shapes and sizes. Fat angels, dog-sized angels, angels upon horseback, etc. I have grown comfortable having these dead for company, and find them agreeable companions, over there in their soil and cold stone houses.
In Wartime Washington, the Civil War Letters of Isabel Perkins. Compiled and edited by Nash Perkins III. Entry of February 25th, 1862. Eight.
So the president left his boy in a loaned tomb and went back to his work for the country.
In Lincoln, A Story for Boys by Maxwell Flagg.
Nothing could have been more peaceful or more beautiful than the situation of this tomb, and it was completely undiscoverable to the casual cemetery visitor, being the very last tomb on the left at the extreme far reaches of the grounds. at the top of an almost perpendicular hillside that descended to Rock Creek below. The rapid water made a pleasant rushing sound, and the forest trees stood up bare and strong against the sky.
Kunhart and Kunhart opposite. Nine.
Early in my youth, I found I had a certain predilection, which to me felt quite natural and even wonderful. But to others, my father, mother, brothers, friends, teachers, clergy, grandparents, my predilection did not seem natural or wonderful at all, but perverse and shameful, and hence I suffered. Must I deny my predilection in Mary and doom myself to a certain, shall we say, dearth of fulfillment? I wished to be happy, as I believe all wish to be happy, and so undertook an innocent, well, a rather innocent, friendship with a fellow in my school, but we soon saw that there was no hope for us, and so, to race past a few details and stops and starts and fresh beginnings and heartfelt resolutions and betrayals of those resolutions, there, in one corner of the carriage house and so on, one afternoon, a day or so after a particularly frank talk in which Gilbert stated his intention to henceforth live correctly, I took a butcher knife to my room, and after writing a note to my parents, "I am sorry," was the gist, and another, "to him, I have loved, and therefore depart fulfilled," I slit my wrists rather savagely over a porcelain tub. Feeling nauseous at the quantity of blood and its sudden percussive redness against the whiteness of the tub, I settled myself woozily down on the floor, at which time I, well, it is a little embarrassing, but let me just say it, I changed my mind. Only then, nearly out the door, so to speak, did I realize how unspeakably beautiful all this was, how precisely engineered for our pleasure, and saw that I was on the brink of squandering a wondrous gift, the gift of being allowed every day to wander this vast sensual paradise, this grand marketplace, lovingly stocked with every sublime thing, swarms of insects dancing in slant rays of August sun, a trio of black horses standing hock deep and head to head in a field of snow, a waft of beef broth arriving breeze-borne from an orange-hued window on a chill autumn.
Sir? Friend.
Am I doing it again?
You are. Take a breath. All is well. I believe you are somewhat alarming our new arrival.
Many apologies, young sir. I only meant, in my way, to welcome you.
Feeling nauseous at the quantity of blood, you settled yourself woozily down on the floor and changed your mind.
Yes, feeling nauseous at the quantity of blood and its sudden percussive redness against the whiteness of the tub, I settled myself woozily down on the floor, at which time I changed my mind. Knowing that my only hope was to be found by one of the servants, I stumbled to the stairs and threw myself down. From there, I managed to crawl into the kitchen, which is where I remain. I am waiting to be discovered, having come to rest on the floor, head against the stove, upended chair nearby, sliver of an orange peel against my cheek, so that I may be revived and rise and clean up the awful mess I have made. Mother will not be pleased, and go outside into that beautiful world, a new and more courageous man, and begin to live. Will I follow my predilection? I will, with gusto. Having come so close to losing everything, I am freed now of all fear, hesitation, and timidity, and once revived, intend to devoutly wander the earth, imbibing, smelling, sampling, loving whomever I please, touching, tasting, standing very still among the beautiful things of this world, such as, for example, a sleeping dog dream-kicking in a tree-shade triangle. A sugar pyramid upon a black wood tabletop being rearranged grain by grain by an indiscernible draft. A cloud passing ship-like above a rounded green hill, atop which a line of colored shirts energetically dance in the wind, while down below in town a purple-blue day unfolds, the muse of spring incarnate, each moist-grassed, flower-pierced yard gone positively mad with...
Friend, Bevins!
Bevins had several sets of eyes, all darting to and fro, several noses, all sniffing. His hands, he had multiple sets of hands, or else his hands were so quick they seemed to be many, struck this way and that, picking things up, bringing them to his face with the most inquisitive, little bit scary. In telling his story, he had grown so many extra eyes and noses and hands that his body all but vanished. Eyes like grapes on a vine, hands feeling the eyes, noses smelling the hands, slashes on every one of the wrists.
Willie Lincoln.
The newcomer sat on the roof of his sick house, staring down in wonder at Mr. Bevins.
Occasionally stealing an amazed glance over at you, sir, at your considerable—
Come now, no need to speak of—
The other man, the one hit by a beam, quite naked, member swollen to the size of— could not take my eyes off. It bounced as he— body like a dumpling, broad flat nose like a sheep's, quite naked indeed. Awful dent in the head. How could he walk around and talk with such a nasty—
Presently we found ourselves joined by the Reverend Everly Thomas.
Who arrived as he always arrives at a hobbling sprint, eyebrows arched high, looking behind himself anxiously, hair sticking straight up, mouth in a perfect O of terror, and yet spoke as he always speaks with the utmost calmness and good sense.
A newcomer, said the Reverend. I believe we have the honor of addressing a Mr. Carroll, Mr. Bevins said. The lad only looked at us blankly.
The newcomer was a boy of some 10 or 11 years, a handsome little fellow, blinking and gazing cautiously about him.
The Reverend Everly Thomas.
Resembling a fish who, having washed ashore, lies immobile and alert, acutely aware of its vulnerability.
Putting me in mind of a nephew of mine who had once fallen through the ice of the river and come home chilled to the bone. Fearful of his punishment, he had not the nerve to step inside. I found him leaning against the door for what warmth he could gain in that way, stunned, guilty, nearly insensate with cold.
No doubt you are feeling a certain pull, Mr. Volman said, an urge to go somewhere more comfortable. I feel I am to wait, the boy said. It speaks, said Mr. Bevins.
Wait for what? Mr. Sheep Dumpling said. My mother, I said. My father, they will come shortly, to collect me. Mr. Sheep Dumpling shook his head sadly. His member also shook, sadly. They may come, said the many-eyed man, but I doubt they will collect you. Then all three laughed, with much clapping of the many-eyed man's many hands, and waggling of Mr. Sheep Dumpling's swollen member. Even the Reverend laughed, though laughing he still looked frightened. In any event, they will not stay long, said Mr. Sheep Dumpling. All the while wishing themselves elsewhere, said the many-eyed man. Thinking only of lunch, said the Reverend. It is soon to be spring. The Christmas toys barely played with. I have a glass soldier whose head can turn, the epaulets interchangeable. Soon flowers will bloom. Lawrence from the garden shed will give us each a cup of seeds. I am to wait, I said.
10.
I shot Mr. Bevins a look.
These young ones are not meant to tarry.
Matheson, aged 9 years, tarried less than 30 minutes, then dispersed with a small fart-like pop. Dwyer, 6 years and 5 months, was not in the sick box upon its arrival, had apparently vacated in transit. Sullivan, infant, tarried 12 or 13 minutes, a crawling, squalling ball of frustrated light. Russo, taken in her sixth year and light of a mother's eye? Tarried a mere 4 minutes. Looking behind stone after stone, I am investigating after my schoolbook.
Poor dear.
The Evans twins departed this sorry veil together at 15 years, 8 months, tarried 9 minutes, then left at precisely the same instant, twins to the end. Percival Strout, aged 17 years, tarried 40 minutes. Sally Burgess, 12 years and dear to all, tarried 17 minutes.
Belinda French, baby, remember her?
The size of a loaf of bread and just lay there, giving off a dull white light and that high-pitched keening.
For 57 straight minutes.
Long after her mother, Amanda French, lost bringing life to a fair and yet unlucky child, had gone on.
They lay together in a single sick box.
A most touching sight.
But in time she went.
As these young ones should.
As most do, quite naturally.
Or else.
Imagine our surprise, then, when, passing by an hour or so later, we found the lad still on the roof, looking expectantly about, as if waiting for a carriage to arrive and whisk him away.
And pardon me for saying so, but that wild onion stench the young exude when tarrying was quite thick already.
Something needed to be done.
11.
Walk with us, lad, Mr. Sheep Dumpling said. There is someone we would like you to meet.
Can you walk? Said the many-eyed man. I found that I could. Could walk. Could skim. Could even walk skim. A little walk skim was bully by me. Something was lying untoward below us, in a box inside that little house. Untoward. Lee. May I tell you something? It had the face of a worm. A worm, I say. A worm the size of a boy. Wearing my suit. Horrors.
The lad made as if to take my hand, then seemed to think better of it, perhaps not wishing me to think him childish.
And we set off, making our way east.
12.
Hello, kind sirs. If you wish, I can tell you the names of some of our wildwood flowers.
Mrs. Elizabeth Crawford.
Mrs. Crawford fell in behind us, assuming her customary posture of extreme obeisance, bowing, smiling, scraping, flinching.
There is, for example, the wild sweet William, wild pink lady slipper, wild roses of all types. There is butterfly weed. There is honeysuckle, and not to mention blue flag, yellow flag, and a great many other kinds that I can't recollect the names of at this time.
Being harassed all the while by Longstreet, that wretch who resides near the askew bench.
Mark you, gentlemen, my subtle understanding of the significant aspects of the costuming. The hooks and eyes, the Ellis Inn, the intricate rainy daisy skirt. I tell you, Scudder, it's like peeling an onion. Unlacing, unhooking, cajoling, until one gets, at last, hardly at a fast pace, to the center of the drama, the jewel, as one would say, its bosky dell.
Sam Smoothboy Longstreet.
Who groped and pawed her continually as we went along, Mrs. Crawford remaining blessedly oblivious to his disgusting attentions.
The lad, overawed, followed close behind us, looking this way and that.
Well, now I will give you a part of, or all of, if you like it, a song my dear husband used to sing, called it Adam and Eve's Wedding Song. This song was sung by him at my sister's wedding. He was much in the habit of making songs and singing of them, and... Oh, no, I won't go no closer. Good day to you, sirs.
We had reached the edge of an uninhabited wilderness of some several hundred yards that ended in the dreaded iron fence.
That noxious limit beyond which we could not venture.
How we hated the thing.
The trainer girl lay, as usual, trapped against and part of the fence, manifesting at that moment as a sort of horrid, blackened furnace.
I could not help but recall her first day here, when she uninterruptedly manifested as a spinning young girl in a summer frock of continually shifting color.
I called out to her and asked her to speak to the lad about the perils of this place for the young.
The girl was silent. The door of the furnace she was at that moment only opened, then closed, affording us a brief glimpse of the terrible orange place of heat within.
She rapidly transmuted into the fallen bridge, the vulture, the large dog, the terrible hag gorging on black cake, the stand of flood-ravaged corn, the umbrella ripped open by a wind we could not feel.
Our earnest pleadings did no good. The girl would not talk.
We turned to go.
Something about the lad had touched her. The umbrella became the corn the hag the girl.
She gestured for him to step forward.
The lad approaching cautiously, she began to speak in a low voice we could not hear.
13.
Young Mr. Bristol desired me. Young Mr. Fellows and Mr. Delway desired me. Of an evening they would sit on the grass around me, and in their eyes burn the fiercest, kindest desire. In my grape smock I would sit in the wicker chair amid that circle of admiring, fierce, kind eyes, even unto the night when one or another boy would lay back and say, "Oh, the stars!" And I would say, "Oh, yes, how fine they look tonight." Well, I admit, imagining reclining there beside him. And the other boys, seeing me looking at the reclining one, would also imagine going down to recline there beside me. It was all very... Then Mother would send Annie to come get me. I was too early departed from that party, from that bright promise of nights and nights of that, culminating in a choice, and the choice being made, it would be right, and would become love, and love would become baby, and that is all I ask. I wanted so much to hold a dear babe. I know very well I do not look as pretty as I once have, and over time, I admit, I have come to know certain words I did not formerly. Fuck, cock, shit, ream, ravage. As fuck. And to know in my mind certain untoward quarters where such things, dim rum-swoggling places off back alleys, come to love them, crave them places, and feel such anger I did not get any thing, was gone too soon to get only 14 years of age. Please do come again, sir. It has been a pleasure. To make your... But fuck your ancient friends, do not bring them again, who come to ogle and mock me and ask me to swindle. No, that is not the word. Slender? Slander? That which I am doing, which is no more than what they are doing, is it not so? What I am doing, if I only carry on faithfully, will, I am sure, bring about that longed-for return to... green grass, kind looks...
Elise Trainer. 14.
Leaving that place, the lad went quiet. "That will happen to me," he said. "It most certainly will," Mr. Volman said. It is somewhat happening already," the Reverend added delicately.
We had reached the place where the dirt path drops down.
Near Freely, near Stevens, near the four infant Nesbits and their head-bent angel.
Near Masterton, near Ambusti, near the obelisk and the three benches and the high-mounted bust of arrogant Merridale.
I believe, then, that I must do as you say, the boy said. Good lad, said Mr. Volman.
15.
We embraced the boy at the door of his white stone home.
He gave us a shy smile, not untouched by trepidation at what was to come.
"Go on," Mr. Bevan said gently. "It is for the best."
"Off you go," Mr. Volman said. "Nothing left for you here."
"Goodbye, then," the lad said. "Nothing scary about it," Mr. Bevan said. "Perfectly natural."
Then it happened.
An extraordinary occurrence.
Unprecedented, really.
The boy's gaze moved past us.
He seemed to catch sight of something beyond.
His face lit up with joy.
"Father," he said.
16.
An exceedingly tall and unkempt fellow was making his way toward us through the darkness.
This was highly irregular. It was after hours. The front gate would be locked.
The boy had been delivered only that day. That is to say, the man had most likely been here
quite recently.
That afternoon.
Highly irregular.
The gentleman seemed lost. Several times he stopped, looked about, retraced his steps, reversed course.
He was softly sobbing.
He was not sobbing. My friend remembers incorrectly. He was winded. He did not sob.
He was softly sobbing, his sadness aggravated by his mounting frustration at being lost.
He moved stiffly, all elbows and knees.
Bursting out of the doorway, the lad took off running toward the man, a look of joy on his face.
Which turned to consternation when the man failed to sweep him up in his arms, as, one gathered, must have been their custom.
The boy, instead, passing through the man as the man continued to walk toward the white stone home, sobbing.
He was not sobbing. He was very much under control and moved with great dignity and certainty of—
He was 15 yards away now, headed directly toward us.
The Reverend suggested we yield the path.
The Reverend having strong feelings about the impropriety of allowing oneself to be passed through.
The man reached the white stone home and let himself in with a key, the lad then following him in.
Mr. Bevins, Mr. Volman, and I, concerned for the boy's welfare, moved into the doorway.
The man then did something. I do not quite know how to—
He was a large fellow, quite strong apparently, strong enough to be able to slide the boy's—
Sick box.
The man slid the box out of the slot in the wall and set it down upon the floor.
And opened it.
Kneeling before the box, the man looked down upon that which—
He looked down upon the lad's prone form in the sick box.
Yes.
At which point he sobbed.
He had been sobbing all along.
He emitted a single heart-rending sob.
Or gasp. I heard it as more of a gasp of recognition.
Of recollection.
Of suddenly remembering what had been lost.
And touched the face and hair fondly.
As no doubt he had many times done when the boy was—
Less sick.
A gasp of recognition, as if to say, here he is again, my child, just as he was. I have found him again, he who was so dear to me.
Who was still so dear.
Yes.
The loss having been quite recent.
17.
Willie Lincoln was wasting away.
Epstein opposite.
The days dragged wearily by, and he grew weaker and more shadow-like.
Keckley opposite.
Lincoln's secretary, William Stoddard, recalled the question on everyone's lips. Is there no hope? Not any, so the doctors say.
In Team of Rivals, The Political Genius of Abraham Lincoln by Doris Kearns Goodwin.
At about 5 o'clock this afternoon, I was lying half asleep on the sofa in my office when his entrance aroused me. "Well, Nicolay," said he, choking with emotion, "my boy is gone. He's actually gone," and bursting into tears, turned and went into his own office.
In With Lincoln in the White House by John G. Nicolay, edited by Michael Burlingame.
The death was only moments ago. The body lay upon the bed, the coverlet thrown back. He wore the pale blue pajamas. His arms lay at his sides. The cheeks were still inflamed. Three pillows lay in a heap on the floor. The small side table was askew, as if roughly pushed aside.
In Eyewitness to History, The Lincoln White House, edited by Stone Hilliard, account of Sophie Lennox made.
I assisted in washing him and dressing him, and then laid him on the bed when Mr. Lincoln came in. I never saw a man so bowed down with grief. He came to the bed, lifted the cover from the face of his child, gazed at it long and lovingly and earnestly, murmuring, "My poor boy, he was too good for this earth. God has called him home. I know that he is much better off in heaven. But then we loved him so. It is hard, hard to have him die."
Keckley Opsit.
He was his father's favorite. They were intimates, often seen hand in hand.
Keckley Opsit, account of Nathaniel Parker Willis.
He was his father over again, both in magnetic personality and in all his gifts and tastes.
In Lincoln's Sons, by Ruth Painter Randall.
He was the child in whom Lincoln had invested his fondest hopes, a small mirror of himself, as it were, to whom he could speak frankly, openly, and confidingly.
In Reckoning, an Insider's Memories of Difficult Times, by Tyron Fillion.
Will was the true picture of Mr. Lincoln in every way, even to carrying his head slightly inclined toward his left shoulder.
Burlingame Opsit, account of a Springfield neighbor.
One feels such love for the little ones, such anticipation, that all that is lovely in life will be known by them. Such fondness for that set of attributes manifested uniquely in each. Mannerisms of bravado, of vulnerability, habits of speech and mispronouncement and so forth, the smell of the hair and head, the feel of the tiny hand in yours. And then the little one is gone, taken. One is thunderstruck that such a brutal violation has occurred in what had previously seemed a benevolent world. From nothingness, there arose great love. Now, its source nullified. That love, searching and sick, converts to the most abysmal suffering imaginable.
In Essay Upon the Loss of a Child by Mrs. Rose Milland.
"This is the hardest trial of my life," he confessed to the nurse. "And in a spirit of rebellion, this man, overweighted with care and sorrows, cried out, 'Why is it? Why is it?'"
In Abraham Lincoln, The Boy and the Man by James Morgan.
Great sobs choked his utterance. He buried his head in his hands, and his tall frame was convulsed with emotion. I stood at the foot of the bed, my eyes full of tears, looking at the man in silent, awe-stricken wonder. His grief unnerved him and made him a weak, passive child. I did not dream that his rugged nature could be so moved. I shall never forget those solemn moments. Genius and greatness, weeping over love's lost idol.
Keckley, Opsit. 18.
Willie Lincoln was the most lovable boy I ever knew. Bright, sensible, sweet-tempered, and gentle-mannered.
In Tad Lincoln's Father by Julia Taft Bain.
He was the sort of child people imagine their children will be before they have children.
Randall Opsit.
His self-possession, aplomb, as the French call it, was extraordinary.
Willis Opsit.
His mind was active, inquisitive, and conscientious. His disposition was amiable and affectionate. His impulses were kind and generous, and his words and manners were gentle and attractive.
In Funeral Oration for Willie Lincoln, by Phineas D. Gurley in Illinois State Journal.
He never failed to seek me out in the crowd, shake hands and make some pleasant remark. And this in a boy of 10 years of age was, to say the least, endearing to a stranger.
Willis, opposite.
Willie had a gray and very baggy suit of clothes, and his style was altogether different from that of the curled darlings of the fashionable mothers.
In The Truth About Mrs. Lincoln by Laura Searing, writing as Howard Glendon.
I was one day passing the White House when he was outside with a playfellow on the sidewalk. Mr. Seward drove in with Prince Napoleon and two of his suite in the carriage, and in a mock heroic way, terms of intimacy evidently existing between the boy and the secretary, the official gentleman took off his hat, and the Napoleon did the same, all making the young prince president a ceremonial salute. Not a bit staggered with the homage, Willie drew himself up to his full height, took off his little cap with graceful self-possession, and bowed down formally to the ground, like a little ambassador.
Willis, opposite.
There was a glow of intelligence and feeling on his face, which made him particularly interesting, and caused strangers to speak of him as a fine little fellow.
Searing, opposite.
It is easy to see how a child thus endowed would, in the course of 11 years, entwine himself round the hearts of those who knew him best.
Gurley, opposite.
A sunny child, dear and direct, abundantly open to the charms of the world.
In They Knew the Lincoln Boys by Carol Dreiser, account of Simon Weber.
A sweet little muffin of a fellow, round and pale, a long shock of bangs often falling before his eyes, who would, when he found himself moved or shy, involuntarily perform a rapid opening and closing of the eyes, blink, blink, blink.
In The President's Little Men by Opal Stragner.
When confronted with some little unfairness, his face would darken with concern, and his eyes well up with tears, as if, in that unfortunate particular, he had intuited the injustice of the larger enterprise. Once a playmate brought along a dead robin he had just killed with a stone, held tong-like between two sticks. Willie spoke brusquely to the boy, seized the bird away, took it off to bury it, was low and quiet for the rest of the day.
In Lincoln's Lost Angel by Simon Iverness.
His leading trait seemed to be a fearless and kindly frankness, willing that everything should be as different as it pleased, but resting unmoved in his own conscious single-heartedness. I found I was studying him irresistibly, as one of those sweet problems of childhood that the world is blessed with in rare places.
Willis, opposite.
Privately, after the service, Dr. Gurley told people that shortly before death, Willie had asked him to take the $6 that were his savings out of the bank on his bureau and give them to the Missionary Society.
Cunhart and Cunhart, opposite.
With all the splendor that was around this little fellow in his new home, he was so bravely and beautifully himself, and that only. A wildflower transplanted from the prairie to the hothouse, he retained his prairie habits, unalterably pure and simple, till he died.
Willis, opposite.
Many months later, going through some old clothing for Mrs. Lincoln, I found, in a coat pocket, a tiny wadded-up mitten. Many memories came back to me, and I burst into tears. I will remember that little boy forever, and his sweet ways.
Hilliard, opposite, account of Sophie Lennox, Maid.
He was not perfect. He was, remember, a little boy. Could be wild, naughty, overwrought. He was a boy. However, it must be said, he was quite a good boy.
Hilliard opposite, account of D. Strumport, butler. 19.
About noon, the president, Mrs. Lincoln, and Robert came down and visited the lost and loved one for the last time, together. They desired that there should be no spectator of their last sad moments in that house with their dead child and brother. They remained nearly half an hour. While they were thus engaged, there came one of the heaviest storms of rain and wind that has visited this city for years, and the terrible storm without seemed almost in unison with the storm of grief within.
In Witness to the Young Republic, A Yankee's Journal, 1828-1870, by Benjamin Brown French, edited by D.B. Cole and J.J. McDonough.
During the half hour the family was closeted with the dead boy, lightning cleaved the dark sky outside. Thunder as terrible as artillery fire made the crockery shudder, and violent winds charged in from the northwest.
Epstein, opposite.
From throughout the spacious halls that evening, great sounds of grief could be heard, not all emanating from the direction of the room where Mrs. Lincoln lay insensate. The president's deeper groans could also be heard.
In My 10 Years at the White House, by Elliot Sternlett.
A century and a half has passed, and yet it still seems intrusive to dwell upon that horrible scene. The shock, the querulous disbelief, the savage cries of sorrow.
Epstein, opposite.
It was only just at bedtime, when the boy would normally present himself for some talk or roughhousing, that Mr. Lincoln seemed truly mindful of the irreversibility of the loss.
In Selected Memories from a Life of Service, by Stanley Honer.
Around midnight, I entered to ask if I could bring him something. The sight of him shocked me. His hair was wild, his face pale, with signs of recent tears plainly evident. I marveled at his agitated manner and wondered what might be the outcome if he did not find some relief. I had recently been to visit an ironworks in the state of Pennsylvania, where a steam release valve had been demonstrated to me. The president's state put me in mind of the necessity of such an apparatus.
Hilliard, opposite, account of D. Strumport, butler. 20.
The unkempt gentleman was fussing over the small form now, stroking the hair, patting and rearranging the pale, doll-like hands.
As the lad stood nearby, uttering many urgent entreaties for his father to look his way, fuss over and pat him.
Which the gentleman appeared not to hear.
Then this already troubling and unseemly display descended to a new level of...
We heard an intake of breath from the Reverend, who, appearance notwithstanding, is not easily shocked.
He is going to pick that child up, the Reverend said.
And so he did. The man lifted the tiny form out of the...
sick box.
The man bent, lifted the tiny form from the box, and with surprising grace for one so ill-made, sat all at once on the floor, gathering it into his lap.
Sinking his head into the place between chin and neck, the gentleman sobbed, raggedly at first, then unreservedly, giving full vent to his emotions.
While the lad darted back and forth nearby, in an apparent agony of frustration.
For nearly 10 minutes, the man held the
sick form.
The boy, frustrated at being denied the attention he felt he deserved, moved in and leaned against his father, as the father continued to hold and gently rock the
sick form.
At one point, moved, I turned away from the scene and found we were not alone.
A crowd had gathered outside.
All were silent.
As the man continued to gently rock his child.
while his child simultaneously stood quietly leaning against him.
Then the gentleman began to speak.
The lad threw one arm familiarly around his father's neck, as he must often have done, and drew himself in closer, until his head was touching his father's head, the better to hear the words the man was whispering into the neck of the—
His frustration then becoming unbearable, the boy began to—
The lad began to enter himself.
As it were.
The boy began to enter himself, had soon entered himself entirely, and at this the man began sobbing anew, as if he could feel the altered condition of that which he held.
It was all too much, too private. And I left that place and walked alone.
As did I.
I lingered there, transfixed, uttering many prayers.